Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is the journalist Andrew Brown, and author of the award-winning book Fishing in Utopia. He writes a regular column in The Guardian on themes concerned with religion, and this is the topic we'll be talking about today. Hello, Andrew. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Welcome. Hi.
Okay, well, maybe can you start, Andrew, by telling us a bit about your background and how you became interested in writing about religion?
I'm afraid to say my interest in writing about religion arose fairly directly from my interest in having enough to eat. When I started out as a journalist, I was actually living in Sweden, and I was a kind of Scandinavian expert for a while. There's not a lot of money in that. I didn't really know this country terribly well because I'd been brought up partly abroad and I'd been living abroad for 7 years. And I got, nothing much really changes. I got interested in a story in Bradford, which was about culture clashes between Muslims and the surrounding community, partly as a result of policies introduced by the then council leader, who was a guy called Eric Pickles. Anyway, this is... I went up there and wrote about it, partly for the Times and partly for a think tank, a rather Thatcherite think tank, an experience which kind of cured me of politics, really. And when the Independent started, they wanted to hire me, and obviously I wanted to be hired. And I didn't have any very clear idea what as, so they said, why don't you be the race and religion correspondent, with the idea then that you write about the kind of Muslimish stories that I had been doing. But it turned out that there was an enormous amount of Church of England stuff going on, so I had to learn about religion, and I did. And if you're going to spend your life writing about something, then you might as well get good at it. And so I became more and more impressed. I spent about 10 years doing that on and off. And then I went off and was a science journalist for about 5 or 6 years, which was great, or mostly science, which I absolutely loved because, it was, made a complete change, or so it seemed to me.
A good balance as well, really.
Skipping the whole sort of new atheist nonsense came up. And one of the things that offended me most about that was that it had absolutely nothing to do with the scientific study of religion. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just nonsense. If you never mind God, what the stuff they said about religion was quite clearly ridiculous and absurd. Mm-hmm. And unlike the stuff about God, was testable and verifiable and clearly nonsense. So Rusbridger asked me to set up a belief website for The Guardian. And I thought this was really quite important because this was a time in the sort of about 10 years ago, maybe, when, people were actually taking all that new atheist bollocks seriously. And I thought it mattered that we get things right. And also, I was and am interested in what religion is and why people believe in it and stuff like that.
Okay, great. Right, well, let's start then. The Chinese sometimes define religion as coming to terms with the great matter of birth and death. What are your thoughts on that perspective?
I don't think that's enough. I'm my own instinct, as it were, is much more to look in sort of Durkheim-like directions as religion is. Religion is interesting because it is both individual and collective.
Yeah.
And you can't have a religion on your own. Mm-hmm. Equally, you can't have a collective one that nobody, that makes no difference to anybody inside.
Yeah.
So it's in part about coming to terms with the sheer extraordinary fact of our existence, which is much odder than the fact of our extinction.
But do you think, again, in part, is religion an attempt to provide comforting answers to the questions we pose ourselves when we confront our own mortality, like, I know, what's it all about?
No, I don't think that at all, actually. I don't think there's all that much comfort to be had. There have been a very great many religions which often, you know, damn all contact comfort really in the face of death. You know, you're going to die, that's it. And there's this sort of 20th century or 21st century, you know, presentist bias that religions have to have something to do with the afterlife, and they don't. And also because the enormous importance of ritual and of behavior and so on, it is simply not the case that religions supply comforting ideas or stories which help us to come to terms with death. It's that they provide rituals which, in ways that we cannot articulate, make other people's deaths tolerable.
Okay. Do you think that in order for ritual to be meaningful to us, does ritual have to relate to our experience?
I'm not sure how to make sense of that question. For ritual to work, we have to do it.
Yeah, but sometimes, for example, I'm thinking of my own childhood. When I was taken to church and I did these rituals in the church, it's not something that I could particularly relate to. I could just remember being bored stiff. Whereas I've been in situations where I've been part of a ritual. For example, I was on a retreat recently and we all agreed to have a poetry reading at the beginning of another meditation session. And because everyone bought into that, it was something that was very meaningful to me.
Oh, sure. I mean, you have to have for your rituals to work, they have to be in some sense integrated with the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And one of the problems for Christianity in the last sort of decades is that they simply haven't been.
Yeah.
So people just look at it and think, but this is weird. Or they feel this is weird. That's a serious problem. But I mean, that's a problem that arises in the relationship between one set of ritual and the way you live the rest of your life. And you can't blame one or the other.
Okay. Do you yourself have a working definition for religion, or do you feel it's something that's impossible to pin down?
I think it is completely impossible to come up with a definition that includes everything that is religion and excludes everything that isn't. I think there are certain things which religions do. You can get a kind of functional definition. You can say, is this working like a religion? But then there's the further problem that we have, that because religions are social arrangements, and societies have changed so much. The invention of literacy, for example, profoundly changed what religion might be.
In what way?
Oh, well, for one thing, you could have a scripture. I mean, with literacy, you could have actual, you know, sets of beliefs that were written down and that people could refer to, whereas previously your stories were infinitely plastic and could be retold as suited the needs of the moment.
Mm-hmm. But do you think, because of these texts, even though they are in a more arguably fixed form than an oral tradition, there's still such a degree of ambiguity with them that arguing over them is to an extent just a scholarly quagmire because of their ambiguous nature.
Yeah, they have to be ambiguous to do their job, because if they were completely unambiguous, they wouldn't be any use. They wouldn't stimulate the kind of thought or insight that we need from them, and they couldn't change with the times. I mean, they have to work as metaphor, or else they're no use whatsoever.
Mm.
But I don't think this argument is purely scholarly. I don't think it can be. You can look at, because for the people who take the texts very seriously, who are admittedly a minority of the religious, but, you know, very of the literate religious, but a very influential one, the change in interpretation really, really matters. You know, all the big changes of sympathy and slavery, whatever, you can see these hinged, amongst other things, on textual interpretation.
It's interesting you using the terms there, ambiguity and metaphor. I'm just thinking of the work of Ian McGilchrist and his in his book, The Master and His Emissary, and he talks about the right hemisphere being the hemisphere where our more religious sensibility can be found, and that tends to be the seat of ambiguity and metaphor. I don't know. Are you familiar with his work at all?
I'm reading the book. I've spoken to him. I've read the little sort of summary thing that he put out. I think it's wonderful and fascinating. I have absolutely no way of judging the extent to which the principles that he identifies, the ways of understanding the world that he locates in the right and left hemisphere, actually are located there. I can't, you know, obviously I can't judge the brain cells at all.
Yeah.
But if you see these as two organizing principles, I think what he's saying is fascinating and rather wonderful.
Yeah. Okay. A lot of aversion to religion seems to be towards its more rigid institutional forms and to unprovable dogmatic beliefs. But yeah, we seem to be saying that could be, in many ways, throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Well, I want to unpick that a little. For a start, an awful lot of beliefs of this sort are unprovable. An awful lot of worthwhile things, certainly unprovable by the methods of science. So, you know, we just have to get over that. Secondly, the dogmatism to which people object is other people's dogmatism. It's hard to be... I think we all have a very great need for unexamined dogmas, which we hold very strongly. We just don't think of them that way. But we actually have to have that kind of belief. What's happened to Christianity in the West, or particularly in Europe, I think, is that these dogmatic beliefs suddenly started to look ridiculous. They got to some extent replaced. And I think probably this, people go on and on about how it was science that did this, but I don't think it was. I think it was history. In two ways. The first is in the 19th century, you have the discovery of deep time, the idea that, you know, the biblical chronology just cannot be true. And secondly, there was, up until 1914, an absolutely self-evident, self-confident belief that Christian civilization was the most wonderful thing that had ever happened on this planet. And the two world wars and the absolute, you know, the ruin that was left of Europe afterwards, smashed that up in a way that was immensely destructive, and people shifted their hopes away then from Christianity to some kind of post-Christian humanist whateverism, mostly, which of course has also come rather unglued in the last 20 or 30 years. But this is because the old beliefs religion is profoundly concerned with identity, personal identity, social identity, and it's because the old identity stopped working that we have the crisis of Christianity, I think, in certainly in this country. I mean, I think, my shorthand for what happened to the Church of England is that the England of which it was the Church just disappeared.
Right.
If you go and look at the coronation oath which Queen Elizabeth swore in 1952, it is simply incredible that her successor will do so. And yet at the time it was the purest, greatest expression of Englishness.
Yeah, interesting. Could I just ask you to expand on what you said about, in some ways, we need dogma?
Well, okay, let me give you an example. We all need to believe human rights, for example. I believe that human rights exist. I believe they matter. I'm also aware this is a completely dogmatic belief that it's something that I would teach my children without asking, without encouraging them to say, oh no, surely some people are completely worthless and how do you prove they're not? I think all societies are founded on that kind of thing, and indeed in our individual lives we have that kind of thing. And there's also clearly a great psychological need for people to belong to groups which have particular beliefs, particular standpoints as their defining feature. You see a bit of it in sports fandom, but you see it also, you see an enormous amount on the internet where people will take up opinions purely for their social value. I have an opinion about X because that's what all right thinking people do.
Yeah.
That's a form of dogma, of course it is.
I suppose maybe we're potentially using a different definition. My understanding of dogma or a metaphysical belief is one that's not subject to experience, so it can't be proven or denied. Whereas the examples you gave are, to a large extent, based on experience.
Well, all right, give me an example of the sort of dogma you're thinking of.
Well, you could have dogma in religion, such as the existence of God or the non-existence of God, or you could have a belief in...
Yeah, but you can't say that neither of these are connected to personal experience, because people who hold them passionately are convinced that their experience proves them right. And weave those beliefs into the way they have their experiences. So of course those are connected. Those are only alive because they are given meaning in the experiences of the people who hold them.
Yeah, but I suppose also, I think it's also important not to confuse meaning and belief. I'm thinking of the Quakers, for example, or the mystics who have an archetypal belief in God in an experiential sense, which can be extremely meaningful, but they don't posit an absolute idea of God. They remain agnostic on that position, whether God exists in an absolute sense or not. Now, I find for people who believe in God in that way, in an experiential sense, I find that that's different from saying God exists out there in a representational way. I think there's a difference.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But for any given, my point is when you look at what religious believers actually believe, they clearly do not believe in the official sort of theological statement of, even when you can pin that down to something which it might be possible actually to believe in, whereas quite a lot of them are for quite obvious reasons, like the doctrine of the Trinity or whatever, it is impossible for me to tell whether I do or do not believe in the doctrine of the Trinity because I don't know what it means. obviously nobody wants to believe in something meaningless, but my point is that even the driest and dreariest formulae are only kept alive because they do in fact carry some meaning to the people who keep them alive. But there's been lovely experiments done. You know, you go to fundamental, you know, churches in America which define themselves as Bible believing and ask people to recite the Ten Commandments, and they can't.
Yeah.
I mean, Bible believing is a beautiful example of what I mean, because I think that to be Bible believing is literally impossible, yet it has a very clear social meaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm not disagreeing there, Andrew. I think that, for example, if someone said they have an experiential understanding of God in a meaningful way, as long as they, I think they have to define their terms. We can't experience an infinite and perfect God because we are finite and imperfect beings.
Yeah, but an enormous amount of, I mean, if you're looking at a religion as a social phenomenon, it consists almost entirely of people who are not having experiences of God. And basically, my interest, my study of it is as a social phenomenon rather than as a piece of introspection, as it were.
Yeah, well, I can agree with that. What are your thoughts on the philosopher Ninian Smart's six dimensions of religion, the mythic, the social, experiential, ethical, doctrinal, and ritual? Only the fifth, the doctrinal, is specifically about belief. And even then, there remains the question of whether religious beliefs are necessarily metaphysical.
It sounds plausible, but I haven't thought it through at all. I haven't read that part of him.
Well, I could expand on that a bit. Robert Ellis, the chair of the society, suggests that to claim to not be religious is about as meaningful as claiming not to be historical or not to be geographical, and that religion is simply an aspect of human experience.
I think that's probably true, but the difficulty with it is that when you go back to the idea that religion is impossible to define or to pin down, I think that religion deals with ineluctable aspects of human experience, but they're not always the same aspects as between religions. And one of the difficulties I have with the word is that is precisely the enormous ambiguity of it. And the way in which there are societies which, for any given definition of religion, there are societies which appear to be without it. So the Robert Ellis line that everybody's got it isn't actually as helpful as you'd like it to be, because, it comes out of a particular polemic with people who say, oh, we could get rid of all that rubbish and think rationally or whatever, which I completely agree with him. That's a pointless exercise. But I'm not sure that as a general statement, it's helpful to say that you can't get away from religion, because as I say, for any given definition of religion, you most certainly can.
I suppose what he's trying to get at is that if we accept the idea that the religion is just a basic aspect of human experience, then arguably if we abandon it or turn our back on it, aren't we in some way deceiving ourselves and merely repressing the religious element of our experience?
My difficulty with that is that in some polemic context it makes sense, but the point is that because religion is itself so baggy a concept, and that there is no form of religion which couldn't be excluded by another definition of it, it doesn't make sense outside particular polemics against people who claim we have outgrown religion, which I think is absurd, because clearly the things that religion does are things which any society needs doing.
Mm-hmm. And what are those things?
Gives us a language to talk about ourselves with, and not just a language, but a set of rituals that reconcile us to life and to death. Will that do?
Yeah, that's great. Okay.
And slightly less ghastly shit like marriage.
Do you think if people could re-engage with religion, it could help them to live more integrated lives?
Well, we note the sudden jump from the previous thing saying people can't actually be without religion, and if they think they are, they're fooling themselves, to, oh yes, wait a minute, they need to get back to it. I think, yes, possibly. I hesitate to be dogmatic about this. I think that, again, we bump into this definition problem. Under certain definitions of religion, if it helps you to lead an integrated life, if it helps you to integrate and to understand yourself, then it is religious. So what you just said is a kind of tautology. If we locate that in the context of arguments with people who think, you know, religion is over and done with, we should grow out of it, well, of course they're wrong, and I entirely agree with, you know, I entirely agree with the statement, but taken outside of that context, it does have problems.
Okay. Well, my final question, Andrew, what is your understanding of the middle way, and how do you think it might relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, I don't really have an understanding of the middle way. I mean, it's, you know, I'm sorry to be disappointing, but there's a long tradition of things it might mean, which are good, you know. I mean, there's sort of Aristotelian mean, and there's the surely related Anglican idea of the via media and all that. At the same time, there's the lovely Texan saying that the only thing you find in the middle of the road is white lines and squashed armadillos. I'm worried about any slogan or any belief system which appears to provide a universal answer.
Uh-huh. What do you think of the idea? But the central idea with the middle way is the idea that by avoiding dogmatic beliefs, you can make better judgments.
Well, if you mean we ought to reason carefully about what we do, well, of course I agree with this. But again, for example, if it means anything more than that or beyond that, then I have difficulties.
Yeah. Well, it's not just about reasoning. It's about avoiding beliefs that are not subject to experience.
So it's something much more like pragmatism.
John Dewey, in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously we ought to test constantly what we do against experience.
Yeah.
But you know, that doesn't actually get you very far, because there are very few people who, on things that actually matter, don't test it at all against experience. Most of us do so rather inadequately or sort of dishonestly or half-heartedly. Mm-hmm. But there's also the point that, you know, we are extraordinarily good at self-deception. We can test all kinds of things against experience and conclude, oh, that's wonderful, experience shows we're right.
Mm-hmm. But then, again, arguably, there's been lots of studies on research on cognitive biases in the last 15, 20 years. And to an extent, maybe that's what you're talking about. But
That's why I'm looking at it. I'm also talking about something which was deeper and well-known before people came up with cognitive bias.
Of course, yes. But again, the middle way is the idea that delusion is inextricably linked with metaphysical belief.
Well, that I completely disagree with. I mean, it's all right as far as it goes, but delusion, self-delusion, is inextricably linked with being human.
Yeah, okay, but then the idea of certainty is also something that is inextricably human too, especially if you are going back to Ian McGilchrist's idea of the left hemisphere being the one that is a closed system and requires certainty to function, then yes, I would agree, but that's the problem, arguably.
Well, if so, it's a problem we can't get away from, because we have to act as if things were certain, even though we know they're not.
In many situations, yes, but then obviously that causes problems at times.
Sure. I mean, look, what worries me about where you're going here is you seem to think that there is, if we could find the middle way or whatever, we could get out of these problems, and I don't think that's possible.
Well, I think the middle way is not a perfect strategy, but what it can do is help you to address conditions better.
Awesome.
The middle way is not a perfect solution at all, but what it is an incremental one by relying on experience. It's the idea that you can make better judgments that are more coherent and with a recognition that of our own limitations too.
I'm in favour of that, obviously.
Yeah, well, that's not what it is, basically. But by doing that, the problem with metaphysical beliefs or dogma is that they can't be incrementalised. They're not provisional in nature, and they're not open to being proven wrong. You either believe them or you don't believe them.
Well, I don't think that's true, actually.
How can you half believe in God?
But lots of people do.
But aren't they just being indecisive? They say sometimes I believe in God or not believe in God. How can you? I don't know how you can believe in God in an incremental way.
I don't see how you can avoid half belief. I think that people are. I think. You know, even Mother Teresa spent years and years, as we know from her confessor's later writings, not believing in God or not experiencing God and just kind of trudging on. And conversely, you know, literature is absolutely full of atheists who are slightly haunted very occasionally by the thought that perhaps they're... I just think that kind of belief is something which, over a long period, we can only half believe. I know we can do dreadful and irrevocable things under the influence of periods of complete belief.
Yeah.
But even so, a bit of you knows that it's gambling.
But again, I suppose I'm trying to make the distinction here between meaning and belief. For example, fairies. I can read the latest Philip Pullman book about the Brothers Grimm, and those stories are incredibly meaningful to me. I think there's an important difference there between meaning and belief.
I mean, I don't want to get too deeply into that.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's been a really interesting discussion with you, Andrew, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Barry. Okay.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.